authorized history of MI6. And on my right, I've got Richard Aldridge, who is a professor at Warwick University and has written the unauthorized history of GCHQ. And I think I'll start by just asking each of the professors to introduce themselves and just tell us what their expertise is that led them into writing these histories. So, Pete,
okay, well,
start.
Thank you, Stella. It's never part of my life's game plan to write the official history or the authorized history of MI6. It kind of popped out of the woodwork, a bit like MI6 itself on occasions, I suppose. But I had been working on a biography of a man called Sir Henry Wilson, who was chief of the Imperial General Staff at the end of the First World War, but more relevantly, was director of military intelligence before the First World War. And when the MI6, or the Secret Intelligence Service, as it's properly known, but its brand name is so powerful, I'll just refer to it as MI6, began thinking about their centenary. It was founded in 1909. They began to think they might do some historical work, and they took soundings among historians. They may have spoken to Richard, I've never asked him, but they've said, you know, we're thinking of doing something. You would get privileged access to the archive. Now that's a real holy grail of British archives. It's completely closed. Would you be interested? Yes, discovering German invasion barges being concentrated on the creeks and the rivers of the German North Sea coast, ready for a boat from the blue, an invasion of Britain, a surprise attack, a kind of Pearl Harbor attack. And that was one of the main worries that they had growing into the second decade of the 20th century. So they needed to know what the German capabilities were, ideally what their intentions were, and they needed to have a kind of early warning system as well. And that all meant putting agents onto the continent of Europe, foreign intelligence from foreign sources. And that's really been the core of the agency's brief. They've done other things as well, but ever since then, and of course into the First World War and after, they moved into looking at places hate the kind of over-glamorization and high expectations of James Bond. They love the over-glamorization of high expectations of James Bond because it does the same sort of thing. And they would kind of dismiss, now you'll be able to defend this, they'd dismiss the kind of five as sort of, rather dull and, very good at what they do, but it's a lot of standing about in Max looking at in wet street corners sort of thing. everyone in the organization identity is secret or a public secret except for the chief. And you're instructed. I did all the usual kind of security classes, as it were, at the beginning. And we have to let them know who knows who you, if you're working in the building, who you're avowed to, and that sort of thing. And about a fortnight after I'd started, I was brought back to the security people just to sort of top up this. And they said, "Well, do you think anyone suspects what you're doing?" And I said, "Well, there's Jim Nocte and 4 million listeners of the Today program," which indicated, you know, this kind of new world that we were living in. And if you look at the SIS, I was complaining to Richard about this earlier. If you look at the SIS website, there's a little strap line at the bottom that says, apart from Sir John Sawyer, who's the chief, and the chief and previous chiefs, the only people who are now, apart from Sir John Sawyer, everyone featured in this website is an actor. Now, you can click on the history bit, and there's a picture of me and my address, and my, my solicitors, of course, get a great sort of claim for destroying my reputation, or maybe I want to be an actor. So there was this kind of exploration. I felt a bit, when I started, like an anthropologist. I mean, one metaphor is, you know, with this distant, very sophisticated, but very peculiar tribe, who had their own ways of doing things. Or, to follow a Second World War metaphor, being dropped behind enemy lines. But there was a welcome committee there. There were friendly faces at the beginning, and we worked out from that. So there were people who were passionately keen on the history of the service being recorded. The problem is, with secrecy, is that for the people working in the service, and particularly today doing very important work, both in 5 and 6, is that they cannot publicise their triumphs, their successes. That's an important part of job satisfaction, but it has to be locked up. It has to be within this tightly controlled situation. But having decided that some of the history could be told up to 1949, and the reason it's such a long time ago is that it doesn't really matter that much up to 1949. National security is not, you know, revealing that we were spying against the Germans and indeed spying against the Americans in the 1920s and 30s. Was no longer a kind of sensational piece of news. The details of how it was done is a different matter. So we were able to, you know, reveal more about this. And the part of the deal, I'll just finish on this, about the access to materials was, again, because only going to 49, is that I had to have, and I did have, I think, absolutely free and unfettered access to the archives. That was part of the deal. There was restrictions on what could come out the other end, but the free access was a sort of deal breaker.
When I was reading your book, I was struck by something that you said, and I may have misunderstood, which was that they'd thrown away a lot of their archives.
Well, this is an operational organisation. It's always been secret. They don't release any documents to the National Archives. They don't think historically. They only keep materials, or they historically have only kept materials if they're of operational use. And a few other bits and pieces, which, like the diary of the first chief, we can't throw that out. But at the end of the First World War and into the 1920s, most of the stuff dealing with the First World War events were thrown away and destroyed, because what's the point of keeping them? It's a waste of space. It's not going to National Archives. It could jeopardize security. People who spied for us might not want their identity to be revealed. Certainly not. They've moved house, offices, head office 6 times in the 20th century. Every time you move house, you throw stuff out. So there are great gaps in the archives. There's a lot of stuff is systematically being destroyed. More to save space as much as anything else, I think. And because what it does was an absolute secret, it would always be a secret, and it's going to remain being a secret.
Which is a big distinction with MI5, who really regards itself as living on its records, because, you know, you need to know what you know in order to understand what you hear, is the philosophy in
great story, and of course grows in the telling. It turns out he didn't lose his whole leg, it was only his foot. When you go to the records and you find the medical record saying, you know, left foot amputated, but still, bad enough. When you think about this story about the paper knife and stabbing, you think he'd spend a lot on his trousers, wouldn't he? He'd have to have, you know, he can't use a dress uniform with these shreds down one thing, you might pick it up. But it tells you something about organisations. That, I mean, it's 5 weeks after his son is killed and he has a bit of his limb amputated, he's back at work. And there's a real stiff upper lip quality to the records in his diary. The day, you know, the day of the accident, there's this kind of shaky entry in pencil, poor old Ali died, and that's it. And you get this insight to this passionate, driven man who has got this work of national importance, and he has to move on. And it's, of course, a story that is repeated a thousandfold in the First World War. But no wonder they worshipped in the organisation. And he saw them safely through the First World War and on a permanent basis. He turns that Secret Service Bureau effectively into MI6.
And that's a culture that they like, I think, even nowadays, don't they?
Oh,
they
yes.
to hark back to the culture of the, you know, the strong man.
Yes. Cumming wrote, he signed himself C, Cumming, single letter, and the chief is still C. He wrote in green ink, and the chief still writes in green ink. So there's a homage today. Sir John Sawyer, if he's in the office, I hope he is, he'll be signing his letter C in green ink.
And do you think that is the model for Smiley? I mean, now going back onto the fiction thing, somewhere in all that comes out Don Le Carré and the Surfers and Smiley, etc.
Smiley's more cerebral than Cumming. I mean, Cumming is a thinker, but he's not an intellectual in the way that Smiley comes through. And I think Smiley is more a product of the Second World War. The organisation grows enormously in the Second World War, and going into the Cold War, into the 1950s, it begins to think much more deeply about what it's doing, and it relates much more integrated into government, and it's bureaucratised to a certain extent, and that's where Smiley comes from, slightly later stage.
Yeah.
I think.
But Smiley has got that sort of dedication to the service of the country.
Absolutely,
and,
yes.
You know, through
yes. I mean that focused commitment.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Are there any literary PCHQs?
There are, but it's thin on the ground. I mean, actually, what's interesting is that Smiley, John Le Carré.
Operations Executive, which are the Special Forces, or one of the Special Forces branches during the Second World War. And it was run out of New York, partly by an organisation called the British Security Coordination, which was the North American office for MI6, MI5, the Codebreakers, and Special Operations Executive. Everything went through this office in New York, partly. And the man at the head of the office is a Canadian called Stevenson, who's a very problematic character, because he did great things, he was very important, but he wanted to be yet more important, and he commissioned sort of hagiographies and very admiring accounts, and when they weren't admiring enough, he commissioned another account which was more admiring, and he invented himself as an even more sensational figure, which has had, of course, the effect of